My name is Shayna Hertzfeld, and I'm a student co-supervisor and project manager for the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm here today with Dr. Amélie Jocelyn-Leray, professor at the University of Toulouse, who is an experienced translator and professor of translation and linguistics. Her recent research interests have focused on crowdsourced and collaborative dictionaries, translation technology, and resources surrounding French Sign Language. She is visiting Dickinson College all the way from Toulouse, France, to deliver a lecture, What Does It Mean to Be a Human Translator in the Age of AI? In this interview, we're going to discuss translation work as a field and the ways that growing technology will influence it. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Well, thank you.
Just to start off, I wanted to ask, your work seems to be primarily with French and English translation. How did you fall into the field and then these two languages specifically? Mm-hmm.
So I was an English major at university. I've always loved the English language. So I started learning English when I was in primary school, which at the time was, original, I would say, because in the old days, you only started learning English later on, in middle school. And I really liked it. So when I had to choose, originally I didn't know I wanted to become a professor, and I just didn't know I was going to teach English. But I was always interested in languages and also other languages. So I also learned German, and I also worked on Latin for a very long time. So at some point, I really had to make a decision, because when I became an English major, then I had to drop Latin, and that was a heartbreak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And I've also learned other languages. Mm-hmm. So I took some Italian classes. I took Arabic, and actually I took Arabic classes here in Dickinson.
Oh, cool.
11 years ago. Mm-hmm. With Magda Sikert, and it was great. And I've started learning sign language as well. So that's for languages. Mm-hmm. And then translation. I first focused on linguistics first, but I think what really made a difference is when I went to Canada for my studies. So I went to the University of Ottawa, and that was for my master's degree. And I spent 1 year there, and I was at the School of Translation and Interpretation. And so that's probably when I really fell into translation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was great. That makes sense. Worked on a dictionary project at the same time.
Yeah. So for my research for this event, I looked into the history of translation a little bit, which you talked about last night, mm-hmm. particularly in the US and Europe for me. And I kind of came across the idea that there are different styles of translation, especially over time, like really mm-hmm. the debate between whether you should stick to the author's original intent or yeah. whether the translator should have more creative license with the text.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think is most used at present? Or is there one that sort of is winning out over the other right now?
Well, as you said, the tendencies changed over time. And so, for instance, at some point there was a very famous trend, which was called Les Belles Infidèles, where you didn't want to be faithful to the source text, but you wanted something which probably, in a way, looked better. You wanted to embellish the text. And I think we're probably quite far away from that now. But the thing is, I think it very much depends, again, on the type of text you're dealing with. So, for instance, I work a lot on translating children's books. And so for the translation of children's books, I've noticed that things have evolved. And for instance, when I was young, I read Famous Five. I don't know if you've heard of Famous Five, but it was a very famous series for children, mm-hmm. a British one. And it was translated into French. And at the time when you read it, you had the feeling, you had no idea that it took place in the UK.
Oh, interesting.
When you read it in French, you had the feeling that it was in Brittany. Because the names had been translated into French, even the place names, things that had to do with the food and everything. So when I was a kid, I loved those books, and I really thought, I had no idea they had been translated. This corresponds to a trend that we call domestication, that Venuti, who's a famous scholar in translation studies, called domestication. This trend has changed, especially for children's books. Now we lean more towards what Venuti calls foreignization, where you want kids to be aware of the fact that there are other cultures, that things, you know, take place differently in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
So now we tend more to like retain the names in the original language and want children to discover other cultures. Well, that's specific, that kind of translation.
Yeah.
But it very much depends on the type of translation you're doing.
That makes sense. Do you think that, like, how do you see this debate going in the future? Or which style do you think wins out, especially with, like, growing types of, like, generative AI and translation technology, machine translation?
The thing is, with translation technologies, what we've seen so far, because there have been studies about this, is that the style of texts is usually less clear when you use machine translation, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because, you know, what makes a style different can be like the syntax or the lexicon that you use. And some of the studies have shown that all of this has been in a way flattened, so that you cannot really see the style of the original author in the... But that was the case especially for neural machine translation. But as I mentioned yesterday, with generative AI now, you have the opportunity to, for instance, write prompts to say that you would like the style to be more, either more creative or more adapted to the author's style. So that might change and that might improve over time.
I know you explained it last night at your talk,
sure.
But would you just explain kind of the evolution of translation technology? Because this is something new that, like, I learned, is that it's not really, technology is not new to the translation field.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's something of a misconception, either in the US or just in general. But would you just explain, like, the evolution over time?
Yeah, sure. Well, try to do it briefly. Translators have been, have had to face technology for quite a long time. And so, for instance, that started with word processing, like in the 1980s. And then there were other tools that we call CAT tools, so that's computer-assisted translation tools. And they've been using this since the 1990s on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And they also deal with like electronic dictionaries, electronic term banks. And for instance, nowadays, people who do subtitling have to know how to use subtitling software. So there are many types of software that translators are using. And as far as machine translation is concerned in particular, it's been around for some translators since the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, it was used in Canada for the translation of Weather Reports between 1975 and 2002. And it's been used at the European Commission since 1975. So they've been going through different systems of machine translation.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, it wasn't necessarily widely used by everyone, but it's been around for a very long time. And now it's really part of their daily job.
Yeah. And so even though it's been around for a long time, I would assume that it's growing to some degree, obviously, over time.
Mm-mm.
How do you think the growing technology has changed? I know last night you mentioned some of the risks. Obviously there's the ethical concerns.
Yeah.
But, I mean, either including or besides those, what do you see as kind of like the risks of using machine translation without human interference or like that using together?
Well, I think that in some fields, there are huge risks.
Right.
So, for instance, I read again last week about the health field, you know, health, for instance, or other, I don't know, diplomacy, for instance, where if you have mistakes, it can really have a huge impact, you know, on somebody's health. Or let's talk about we talked about aeronautics. Oh, no, it wasn't in the conference. But anyway, we talked about aeronautics yesterday, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, same thing. Imagine you're building, you're building a tool, a very precise tool, and then the tool might not be working properly because of a translation mistake. There might be huge consequences.
Right.
So that's also why I mentioned yesterday that I think part of the new translator's job is also to actually teach about translation and tell people what translation really is. Because I think that some people are really not aware of what it implies.
Yeah. And then along, or kind of the flip side of that, are what would be the benefits of using the, these sorts of maybe specific fields that can benefit from machine translation with human translators, or in general, what are the benefits for that?
Well, it's mostly about time and productivity, I guess, reducing the costs as well.
Yeah.
And because you, shouldn't forget that translation is a job, because sometimes you just have this idea of, you know, literary translators, and but, you know, it's your job, you have to make money.
Yeah.
So you can reduce the costs in some areas, which also means that if you reduce the costs, or if you spend less time on a given task, then you have more time or more money and for another task.
Right.
So it's probably the...
Yeah, that makes sense. So with all of that, how would... I was speaking to a professor last night after the event, and she was saying that she wanted to... Like, she wished she had sort of a list or some sort of compilation of risks and benefits to advise, like, newer, like, language students. So not necessarily people who are at that very high level of training to be translators, but just newer students who are, you know, have all these ChatGPT and Google Translate, all these options available to them. What advice would you give either the professor who are teaching these students, or the students themselves, about kind of like how to use these technologies most effectively, I guess?
I think, well, it would probably take time to make like a precise list.
I think
that
in general,
the most important advice, as I said yesterday, is just to understand that machines do not understand.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they do not understand anything. That you shouldn't like consider that the machine is a human being. Mm-hmm. So as I said yesterday, when you are chatting, so inverted commas, right? If you're chatting with ChatGPT, you're chatting with a machine. You're not chatting with a human being.
Right.
So which means that if you're, you know, even saying things in an ironical way, it might not be perceived by the machine.
Right.
Or that some things might be taken at face value. Or so that's probably the most important thing. And also that if you want to, as I said yesterday too, if you want to assess the quality of what is produced by the machine, be it a translation or anything else, like a summary, or, well, first you have to know how to write a summary by yourself.
Right, right.
So for any given task, you have to master the task first to see how what the machine produces can really improve on what you could do by yourself.
Right.
So, and in some cases, and it, I have to say that, for instance, for yesterday, for one or two slides, I used material that I had previously written in French. And I thought, okay, well, probably I could gain time and see if I translated, you know, my slides that I had written in French for another presentation, one or two slides, and see what ChatGPT can do and what DeepL can do. And so I used both for two slides, I think, and ChatGPT was quite good. So it did save me some time. But I still had to edit anyway what was produced by the machine. But it did gain some time. But the thing is, I was able to edit the content because I knew what I wanted to write or wanted to say.
So I guess more of a tool rather than, it's not a substitution. You've talked a lot about like neural AI versus like generative AI and the switch between those. Would you explain sort of very generally, broad strokes, what the actual change between those two AI, like what the functionality is, the difference, and then how it's kind of affected the field of translation and your work?
So it's, well, the thing is, if you want to go into details, it's really technical. Neural machine translation, as I explained yesterday, neural machine translation, so for instance, Google Translate or DeepL or Reverso, they're all NMT engines. So those engines are only for translation, which is not the case for generative AI, right? And they rely on what we call machine learning, deep learning, and neural networks, where the you look at the words within a network, like you try to see how close some words are. So for instance, if you have words like let's say in English, like dog and bark, you're quite likely to find context in which they're really close to each other. Whereas if you have like dog and meow, that's less likely. So,
right.
But again, we're looking at, you know, statistics and these kind of things. And neural machine translation is going to show you maybe how, well, the context in which they're most likely to occur. This is also why, you know, as I said, that the style sometimes might be flattened, because what you're going to be given is something which is like the most frequent thing you can find. But sometimes you just don't want to write like anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
You would like to have your own style.
Mm-hmm.
For generative AI, the texts that I use are even bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that it really like generates texts. It generates texts. Again, it's like predictability. But it's not, generative AI is not aimed at translation in particular. So
mm-hmm.
that's one of the differences.
Yeah.
But it works, as I said, it works quite well also because it adds other elements, as I mentioned yesterday. You can customize it much more, even though NMT engines can be customized.
Mm-hmm.
I think generative AI can help you really customize even more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably why also we get better results.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, moving to a more like kind of specific area of your research,
mm-hmm.
I know you've worked recently with corpus linguistics.
Yeah.
Would you mind just sort of quickly explaining what that is? Like, what does that mean? And kind of like how it interacts with translators' work.
Yeah, sure. So corpus linguistics is a field of linguistics that really started to expand, I would say, maybe in the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned yesterday, this has to do with the development of computing science in general, like, you know, better software, you can store data, these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. And the other thing was also like a shift in paradigm within linguistics, where linguists started to think, I'm making it simple, but like linguists started to think that instead of studying language as they think it should be used, we should study language as it is actually used. So for instance, say, oh no, like, you know, grammar rules, say, oh no, for instance, well, let's say you use each other and one another. The grammar rule is that you're supposed to use each other when there are two people, and that you use one another when there's more than two.
Yeah.
That's the rule, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's a rule that you find like in old grammar books, and that learners of English, in most cases, still learn. But if you look at the way it is actually used by speakers, you can see that this rule is probably not...
I did not know that was a thing.
And that's something you can gather from the study of actual use of language.
Okay.
So that's what corpus linguistics is about. Like, we want to focus on the actual use of language. So to do that, we build corpora.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be corpus of authentic texts. But we also have oral corpora, where you record people and you listen to what people actually say. And there are also what we call multimodal corpora, where you have videos. And for instance, that's what we use for sign language, because you want to, record people signing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is really, been used in translation again since probably the 1990s. So this, the very beginning, was also used, was first used for lexicography, so dictionary making,
mm-hmm.
and dictionary compiling. And so recent dictionaries, and especially dictionaries for learners of English, were based on a corpus of like real English. And this helps for translation, because as I mentioned yesterday, when you translate a text, you want to sound as authentic and as idiomatic as possible. And so that's why it's very, very useful for translation.
Mm-hmm.
And then another step is that those corpora of translated texts are also what is being used now for machine translation.
Right.
So.
And how does machine translation make use of those corpora?
That's where it extracts information, okay. You know,
yeah.
And if you have like, as I mentioned yesterday, when mm-hmm. I talked about Euramis, you know, mm-hmm. the translation memory, which is used at the European Commission. So you have hundreds and hundreds of texts mm-hmm. in their original version and in the translated versions. And then I talked about statistics and probabilities. So the machine can see, you know, that this fragment that we found very often in, I don't know, in a French text has most often been translated as blah, blah, blah. And then that's what your machine translation engine is going to suggest then, because that's, you know, the most frequent translation that has been used previously.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And then you mentioned French Sign Language.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I've been really curious about, and yeah. how specifically like AI and machine translation has affected the use
mm-hmm.
of sign language translation, I guess, or interpretation maybe is better.
Yeah, so I think that for sign language, it's very new. Like and it's not. So there are lots of research projects going on, like
mm-hmm.
starting now that have mm-hmm. been starting. But it's much more complex for sign language,
yeah.
And I think we're very far from being able to have like machine translation that really works for sign language, because
yeah.
it's so different and it's like a 3D language. So for now, what has been going on for the last, I would say like 15 years, is avatars, as I mentioned yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But avatars, then you already like feed the text. It's not translation. It's not proper translation.
Right.
So it's just that you want like a machine to be signing, which is an advantage, because then it's also anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talked about intellectual property yesterday and data. And
right,
the thing with
right.
sign language, and especially for corpora, for instance, is that if you want to record people signing, you see their faces.
Right.
So it can't be anonymous.
Right.
So that's why for sign language, people have been working on avatars for a long time.
Oh, okay.
But as far as machine translation
mm-hmm.
for sign language is concerned, I think we're still, yeah, it's still quite far ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So as we're sort of wrapping up,
yep.
I wanted to ask, what do you hope, or what do you hope people will have taken away from your talk last night or this interview today? Like, what do you think is the most important thing?
I think it might depend on the type of category of people who are listening
yeah.
to me, like students,
uh-huh.
for instance. I really hope that they will like use machine translation more critically, or tools in general anyway,
right, right.
technological tools, you
mm-hmm.
know. So that's one thing, thinking critically in any case.
Yeah.
And I also hope they've learned about translation and the issues of multilingualism, and especially because I know that in Europe, it's something that might be more obvious to us
mm-hmm.
because there are so many languages, and in the US, I know it's a bit less so. So I hope
mm-hmm.
that it might have made people more aware of this too. And the fact that it's not anyone that can translate.
Right,
so,
right. Yeah.
So I was just very happy to be here.
Okay.
So
awesome. Well, we're so happy to have had you.